I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Today we talk with three filmmakers who have films in this year's Woods Hole Film Festival. Lacey Schwartz joins us on the phone to talk about her documentary, Little White Lie. The film poses some important questions. What defines our identity, our family of origin, or the family that raises us? How do we come to terms with the sins and mistakes of our parents? Lacey, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So you grew up in Woodstock, New York, in an upper middle class Jewish household. So tell us about your mom and dad.
What can I tell you? They were both, you know, two white Jewish people from Brooklyn, New York, who then moved upstate when they started a family, or shortly before starting a family. And they were two really loving parents who raised me and supported me pretty much my whole life.
Yeah. And you, your Jewish identity was solid. You have a family of a long line of Jewish people who came to Brooklyn and brought their cultures with them.
Absolutely, yeah. My grandparents were actually born in Brooklyn, so we're like my great grandparents came over through Ellis Island from Eastern Europe, and then settled in Brooklyn. And then we had, as I said, many generations that were kind of New York Jews or born and raised and lived in Brooklyn until my cousins and I were like the first generation that were raised outside of Brooklyn.
Right. And so
I live in Brooklyn now.
Yeah. And in Woodstock, New York, we should say, it was a very white neighborhood. And
Yeah. I mean, I think Woodstock's a really interesting place in the sense that it is very, I mean, it's kind of considered, obviously, from going back to the concert, and really that reputation from the concert came from the fact that it was a long-term artist colony. And so it's really known as a very liberal, open, kind of creative place, but nonetheless very, very white. And so it had like a kind of like a white liberalism to it, and that we didn't really talk about race. Like, it was open, it was accepting, but we didn't talk about race.
And I want to play a clip from the film, which speaks to the one of your earliest memories of you being different.
One day I went to nursery school, and there was this little blonde kid who seemed obsessed with how I looked. And he said to me, "Show me the color of your gums." And I just showed him my gums. I was like...
That's the earliest memory I have of feeling different. It was embarrassing to be singled out, and it made me feel ugly. When I told my parents what had happened, my father pulled out an old photo album and told me I took after his great-grandfather, who was Sicilian.
And I saw pictures, and I said, "Oh, Lace looks like Robert's grandfather."
I just sort of believed what we were told, that somewhere, I don't know, in your family history, there was some explanation for it. You know, the picture of the sort of like Moorish looking, I don't even know what we were told he was.
I believed it. I believed I was white.
And so we should explain, you had darker skin. This is what we're talking about. And you didn't notice it when you were little, and nobody really talked about it. So until you started going to school and people were saying, "Wait a second," and you get this explanation that it's, you know, your great-grandfather who was Sicilian. And that seemed to satisfy people.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't think it was just, you know, an excuse I was made up. I think everybody really believed it.
Yeah. And there were incidents, though, that really started to make you at least think about this. And tell the story at your bat mitzvah. What happened there?
Yeah, I mean, I was part of the Woodstock community, and we were part of a congregation. And a woman at the end of the service came up to me, a woman, and just said, "It's so nice to have an Ethiopian Jew in our presence." Because, you know, very much, and I do a lot of work around diversity and the racial and ethnic diversity in particular in the Jewish community. And for a long time, the narrative around racial diversity in the Jewish community was very much defined by the Ethiopian narrative and the fact that, you know, there was Ethiopian Jews and they were kind of airlifted from Ethiopia in the 80s and ongoing and brought to Israel. And so that was all people could understand. When they saw somebody who was dark-skinned, who was Jewish, they could only understand that somebody would be Ethiopian. Even though I look nothing
like
an Ethiopian.
And, you know, I just want to go back to that, you know, that nursery school incident, too, as well. When you said it made you feel ugly, that made me feel so sad because you were beautiful. I mean, you're a beautiful woman, but you were a beautiful little girl. And so to feel that way, and you had a little diary that had some given you, and I guess you didn't realize it until you look back on it. But one of the things you wrote in there that you wished you had lighter skin.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, we quintessentially look at this film, this story, as a coming of age story. And I think that that's such a part of when you're growing up and how much you're being made to feel comfortable about how you are and how much you conform to the norms. You're not, many times you're not necessarily being raised to believe that your uniqueness is what is in fact so beautiful. Even if your parents are trying to do that, you know, you're going into other settings, school or whatnot, where you're just feeling like if you can't conform, then you're ugly. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't, you know, it's not something that makes you feel good about yourself. Yeah. I think that was very much my experience. It obviously had a much deeper root to it, but I think in certain ways it's a very relatable experience.
Yeah, absolutely. And but this is like this, as somebody says in the film, the 800-pound gorilla in the room. Nobody talked about it. Even so, you know, the family may have maybe had some questions or some thoughts, but nobody ever talked about that. And I thought it was interesting, this idea, again, about your great-grandfather, was also embraced by, you know, it was an explanation even for your friends. And I got another clip here when you talk about going to high school in the next town where there was more diversity. This was the first time you say you crossed paths with black people.
The black girls would stop me in the hallway and say, "What are you?" You know, like I was offending them. And I would just tell them that I was white, that I was, you know, looked like my great-grandfather who was dark-skinned. I would tell them I was Jewish.
The black girls in school would be like, "Well, you have to work some stuff out if you think that, you know, you're completely white." People definitely asked you, "Are you black or why are you trying to be white?"
What those girls didn't seem to understand was I wasn't trying to be white. I was white. Everyone in my life had always let me think so.
I remember specific situations where I'd be like, "Oh, I'm going to hang out with my friend Lacey." And they'd be like, "Oh, Lacey, is she adopted?" And my friends being like, "I mean, clearly she's black." And I'd be like, no, she's white.
So that, what a confusing time for you. You've been told that your friends are telling this, your family is telling you this, and yet, you know, you're looking at this and this can't be. So your parents split up, and that's when you really start to feel there's something you're not being told. Mm-hmm. And at 18, you confront your mother.
Yeah.
And she didn't want to talk about it.
Not initially, no.
But you do get her to talk about it. And with this new knowledge, where you find that your father was indeed black, this confuses you about your identity even more so, so much so that on your application to college, you don't check anything in the race boxes. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, for me, the film is very much about two things, largely. One is about family secrets, which is, I define as, something that everybody knows but nobody talks about, and the other is the power of denial, mm-hmm. which I think is, you know, sometimes is something that is hard for people to completely understand when they're looking straight at it, that people can really convince themselves that something is not how it is. And so there's this period of time where I think that I was very much questioning the world around me in terms of my actual origins and why I looked the way I did, but at the same time, the family that I knew was very much falling apart, so I'm trying to get my bearings. And so there's this period of time where, you know, I kind of think I'm somewhat in the know, but I'm also still carrying around a lot of denial, and I'm still very much, you know, being a member of the family of my family of origin. And there's this really interesting period of time, I think, when I go to college, where I'm ready to kind of at least temporarily sever my ties to my family. I mean, I think that the whole experience of going away to college, if that's what you do, is something that is the first time that you're really going out on your own. You're defining yourself outside of the parameters of your family. Because previous to that, you're either defining yourself, you know, in opposition to them or, you know, because of them, but you're not really figuring out who you are for yourself. And that was the first time that I was really looking at myself and thinking, who am I outside of these people? But I was still quite confused, so I wasn't just going to, like, you know, randomly identify with something that I didn't really have any tie to.
Yeah. And so you, for a while there, you sort of have this dual life, as you say, you have your, you know, your college life and where you are now embracing being part black. And then you have your family where you're still not talking about it. But some of the clips or the scenes in the movie at college I thought were interesting. There's a professor that's talking about, he says there are different narratives of racial identity. And I thought, wow, I thought that was a really profound comment, and I wondered what you thought when you heard that.
know, I mean, I think I really related to it. I mean, one of the things that I felt was, you know, especially being in, like, an institution, the institutions that I went to school in, where there was so much kind of really intellectual conversation around race, from people who were, like, specifically thinking a lot about race, in particular black people, I was really struck by, like, kind of the diversity of what it meant to be black in particular. And so that was something that when I started realizing that and identifying that, that was something that was very comfortable for me, as opposed to a lot of times when I went into, like, Jewish communities where people had kind of, you know, and we're working on this, and it's evolving now, right, in 2014, but it still has a long way to go. So a lot of times when you walk into spaces of, you know, Jewish spaces, people have one idea of what it is to be Jewish. But I was walking into black spaces at that time in these, you know, institutions of higher learning where people had a very expansive view of what it meant to be black, and that was very comfortable to me. So I think that that comment really reflects that.
Yeah.
And the fact that that exists.
We have a clip of a conversation you're having with two of your college friends about being multiracial and being accepted in the black community.
What do you want? Let me ask you a question.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is being biracial, half black, half white, a category of being black? Like, I think of it...
Definitely. Yeah.
Yeah, I think of it that way. Like, I identify as black. Like, being mixed is a category of being black. Being mixed to me is not a category of being white.
It's so funny because you know the whole one drop rule, right? So it's like, one drop of black blood, you're black. So there's all these people who we accept in, you know, like Tiger and his Cabalasian self. You know, everyone's like, yeah, we're claiming that. And so it's just... It is an inclusive, it's beyond race to me. Like, even when I was in India recently, it's kind of brown people, you know, because, like, after there were no black people, I was like, the Indian girl look cool. I'm like, hey, girl, some brown in the building. It's a common connection with sort of being kind of the underdog in some way, not being accepted, and really walking into a room where people are like, I accept you.
That experience, having those girls and girls and guys like them to talk about that, what a different experience for you coming from your neighborhood in Woodstock, New York, where nobody talks about this.
Yeah. I mean, even my closest friends, like some of them we never really actually sat down and really talked about it, my friends growing up, until I made the film.
Yeah. So what did how did your parents react when you told them you wanted to do this film?
You know, I mean, I think it's continuously still happening in a sense. It's a hard question to answer. I mean, in the end, how they reacted is you see it as that they kind of supported me and they had the conversations with me. I think at various times for various people it was harder than others. But in the end they sat down and they did it. And I think that, you know, I am very, through it all, I'm very, you know, thankful to my parents. I think that they've really supported me and loved me through it all. And I think it's complicated. It's a complicated story where there was, you know, different people holding on to different roles. I think with my mother, she is a very complex character in the fact that she's an amazing mother, but she was also a woman who was, you know, going through her life and trying to meet her own needs in various ways. But in the end with the film, they did it. And that's the biggest thing that I can say, is that they were willing to sit down and have these conversations with me.
Yeah. And, you know, this is, I think, another relatable moment for anybody who's watching it, because everybody has complicated family issues and the dynamics and, you know, the relationship that you have with your parents when they're together, and then how the relationship changes, how the family changes when, you know, the family splits. And you can see, you know, you feel for everybody in there, because you can see this. Your mom is struggling. Your dad is certainly struggling. You're struggling, and for different reasons.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you know, and that's, you know, in the end, what I think of as the point of this film really is that, yes, it's a very personal story, and everybody will walk away and they'll think about my story and they'll see it played out, but really for them to think about their own stories. I really believe in the power of the conversation, the power of speaking the truth, and that it can be very redemptive. And that if we have these conversations, then we can move past it, we can move forward with our lives in healthy ways, but that there's really a lot of times no space for that dialogue. Mm-hmm. And so a large point of what this film is about and what we're hoping for other people is that this can be the first step in you know, motivating other people to have those conversations. We have an interactive piece around the film that we're going to be launching at these festival screenings where other people can then also share their family secrets and kind of encourage them. And as we go on and the film gets out there more and more, eventually we're going to screen on PBS, that people will have an opportunity to sit around and dialogue either with their family or their other peers and have these conversations about their own issues, because a lot of people are truly held back by these things and spend their whole life never moving past them.
Yeah. Well, and going back to the family secrets, it's, you know, you struggle with that. And I don't want, you know, we won't give away all the details of the family secrets, but one of the struggles there is, you know, when you're young and in the moment and you make this mistake and then you keep quiet about it, and it touches everybody's lives around you. And certainly that's maybe not the intent in the beginning, but the longer you keep these secrets, we see the damage that can be done.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And it was interesting. I thought another interesting point with your dad. You and your dad were very close growing up, and you have a little rocky time there for a while. As you know, he's kind of coming to terms with the dynamics in the family, and you want to talk about it. And again, they haven't been talking about it, but I thought it was really interesting how you can ignore some obvious for so many years, and then you come to him and tell him that, you know, you identify as a Black woman. And he's like, duh, yeah, of course you do. You know, it's because the music you listen to and the books you read. And it was like, it was this obvious moment to him, yet there was all these other obvious signs that he didn't recognize or didn't want to, I guess, face earlier on.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's an interesting moment in terms of, like, just asking ourselves the question of what is race? Is, you know, is race the music you listen to in the television shows you watch, or, you know, what is that? And I'm not trying to necessarily answer that question, but I want people to ask themselves that question. And I think it can mean different things to different people in different spaces, and certainly is very much a sociological creation. But it's something that we have to really ask ourselves, because race does still have a lot of power in this country, and we really need to be questioning where it comes through and what power it does it have. And I think a lot of times, you know, we're looking at race on a societal level, but we're not necessarily turning it inside of families and really looking at the power that race has within families.
Yeah, good point.
And that's why I think telling stories like this is really important.
Yeah, and I was amazed at the video, because you have used some home video. Obviously, you took some of the video as you were making the documentary. Where along the line did you decide you wanted to make this a documentary about yourself?
Yeah, when I first started doing this film, it was years ago. I was in graduate school and I started thinking about it. And I was at that period of time I was getting into film, and I was just filming everything kind of around me for various projects, but really just kind of starting to do that. And I had some family members who had done that as well, and so that was really useful, you know, when we started putting the film together. But at that period of time, I got really, really interested in the idea of Black Jews in America and really looking at them and thinking, wow, it's so fascinating that there's individuals, you know, I was kind of coming to terms at that time with my being Black and Jewish, and I thought it was so interesting that people could live between two worlds, right? You know, being Black and being Jewish in America are these kind of, you know, iconic American identities. And so the fact that somebody could be both of those was really fascinating, just this idea of what a dual identity is. And so, but when I really started looking at that topic and wanting to make a film on that topic, I had to ask myself, what is the story I want to tell? Because I personally believe that you need a good story. A good topic is not enough for a film. And when I really started to push myself and ask that question, I kind of kept on coming back to my own story and the things that were, you know, were still questions for me that I had to work through, and realized that before I could go out and make a film about kind of a topic another way, I really had to, like, delve into my own story and figure that out and be able to be willing to turn the camera on my own life and use that story to talk about these issues.
I thought it was a great film, and I really enjoyed it. And I like you say, it's a personal story, but you pose some really important questions. And as you say, hopefully you get some conversations started and some reflection as folks watch.
Thank you so much. That really means a lot.
Little White Lie will be screened on Tuesday, July 29th at Redfield Auditorium at 5 and 7 p.m. Lacey Schwartz, thanks so much for taking time to talk to us.
Thank you.
Coming up after a break, we discuss another film being screened at the Woods Hole Film Festival, The Perfect 46. You're listening to The Point. New tests that scan all of a person's genes, that person's genome, are now on the market. Anyone can buy the new scans, mail a saliva sample to a company, and be provided with information about risks of developing specific diseases based on variations found in their genes. A new film being screened at this year's Woods Hole Film Festival takes us into the future of genetic analysis, raising some fundamental questions about what we can and should do with genetic information. The title of the film is The Perfect 46, and filmmaker Brett Bonowitz joins us on the phone. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So give us the premise of the film.
Well, The Perfect 46 is about a geneticist who creates a website, The Perfect 46, that will pair an individual with their ideal genetic partner for children.
And we actually have a short clip from the film. The first and the last voice we hear is Jesse Darden, your character, the founder and CEO of The Perfect 46.
Today we're announcing something new. Something that's going to fundamentally change the way we think about our relationships.
This was going to be the answer to a whole host of diseases.
Not looking at love, really not even looking at those people as people, how could you possibly responsibly make that decision any other way? Jesse made it irresistible.
What we want to do, just like everybody else, is we want to bring down healthcare costs. And our service is the most cost-effective way to do so. This is not eugenics in the sense of the 1930s in America. What we are addressing are future costs, okay? Costs that are associated with defects and disorders. But nobody's been forced to use this service. Nobody's being forced, and that should be pointed out. The goal is, what does it cost to have a child with cystic fibrosis? If we have the technology, why would you not want to avoid that? Why would you not want the best, the absolute best for your child that money and technology could possibly deliver?
Now, when posed that way, the answer to the question seems obvious. Of course you want the best for your child. But your film explores some of the reasons why the question is really more complex. So what are some of the issues you hope the audience begins to ponder as they view the film?
I wanted to make a film that asked a lot of questions and didn't necessarily have, you know, kind of clear-cut answers. You know, I liked the idea of exploring a gray issue. So, I mean, there are a lot of different personal questions, either just about, you know, where to draw the line with what we're doing scientifically, or, you know, different issues about eugenics and even just the history of eugenics throughout America and the world that, you know, I'd really like an audience to start thinking about without definitively having an answer a day or a week, even after seeing the film.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, what is a genetic defect and what is valuable human variation? Of course, who decides what's healthy, what's not? When is it okay to intervene? There's a lot of questions we ponder here. The Perfect 46 has also caught the attention of the scientific community, and you've received praise for getting the science right. So first, why was it important to you that the film be as accurate as possible scientifically? And then can you describe the process of ensuring that it was accurate?
Sure. Having the science accurate to me, I had always wanted to make a science fiction film, but I came from a background of realism, you know, so I wanted to kind of blend those two together, and the closer I got to making the film, the more I just kind of asked myself, well, why not just make this as accurate as possible? It's not that difficult, you know what I mean? If I just kind of move some stuff around, I think the audience experiences it in a different way, knowing that it can happen. You know, it's not a laser beam in space or, you know, living on a moon colony. You know, it's something much closer to home, and I think you have a very different experience knowing that it's all possible.
Yeah, it's true. And and pondering those questions, as you said, because it seems somewhat, it's like, well, this is not science fiction, as you say, far out there, and it does make you think about these questions. We have a second clip that gives us a sense of the issues raised when we have access to more and more information about our genome. The last person you hear speaking in this clip, again, is Jesse Darden.
You're talking about manufacturing a person, okay, a human being, and she's trying to tell you that she's not interested in that, and that's not acceptable to you.
What's not acceptable to me is ignorance. We are, for the first time in human history, able to take our evolution into our own hands. And all I'm hearing is, I'm not interested. This is what I'm fighting against. And for every uphill battle that I have to I have to face. Ignorance and indifference are maybe the most abhorrent ones.
So this clip also highlights some of the emotional dilemmas of being able to find your perfect genetic match. What are the potential impacts on human relationships, and what is the role of love?
The way things are now with, you know, people, you know, using like an app, you know, to meet people, you know, what's the difference? You know, how are we starting our relationships? I think is kind of maybe what's going to change in the future. You know, will we start it with genetics? You know, will we start it just with an image? You know, have we always started it with an image just by looking at someone in the town versus, you know, an image online? You know, I think a lot of the beginnings are kind of the same. It's just what we're looking at might change, you know, and it might move into genetics.
The character of Jesse Darden is complex. At times he's loathsome, and at times one could admire him for his goal of obliterating human disease. So tell us about your development of the character of Jesse and about Whit Hertford, the actor who plays him.
I really wanted to, you know, kind of explore, you know, like a tech CEO type character. So I looked a lot at like a Steve Jobs or like a Jeff Bezos or something. And, they're really complex, and you know, they have a lot of little character quirks. They each have their own kind of thing, and I felt like it would be kind of dishonest to, you know, have him just be endlessly likable. You know, I like the idea that you can admire certain aspects of him, and then you know, abhor how he might handle a different situation. And you know, they're all kind of antisocial in their own ways, or in certain ways. And that was interesting to explore because, you know, in Jesse's case, you know, he really wants to do something that he thinks, you know, is really improving society and humanity. And it's like, well, where does that drive come from if he's not even that well-behaved around people, you know?
Mm-hmm. So the Perfect 46 is set in the not-too-distant future, and when we look back into the not-too-distant past, things such as in vitro fertilization generated a lot of talk and concern back then, but are commonplace now, and we already routinely test in utero for various genetic diseases. Do you think the question of what is natural and acceptable is a moving target that changes with the times?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, you know, science fiction is always a reflection of the time that it's being made. You know, like 2001 A Space Odyssey is, you know, a reflection of, you know, the hope of 1960s space exploration. Even just looking at, like, a film like Gattaca, you know, that a lot of that comes from, like, the fear of cloning Dolly the sheep. Mm-hmm. You know, so looking at where we are now with genetics, you know, I think the Perfect 46 is a reflection of not even necessarily fears, but even just kind of an extrapolation of where we might be going. And whether or not that's going to be accurate, I have no idea. You know, I can't possibly know that. But I know, though, that the film is a reflection of where we are today.
So what is it you're hoping people walk away with when they watch this film and they walk away? What are you hoping is going to be happening with their conversations?
Questions. I want people to think about how they feel about a lot of these matters. You know, I think before making the film, I hadn't really thought about a lot of the issues in the film, and it just became like this rabbit hole of kind of going down and just finding more and more and more and you know, more interesting things. Just to even, you know, about the history of eugenics in America. You know, is something that I don't think is really talked about really or explored very much. And I think if we're going to be headed down this genetic road, you know, I think we have to have a sense of history. And, you know, I think as an audience member leaving, if they, you know, wanted to continue reading about the subject or look something up or even just discuss it with a friend, you know, I don't want somebody to leave having it go in one ear and out the other. You know, that would be a disappointment.
Yeah. I think it'd be interesting too for people to go, wait a second, is that true when you're looking at the history? And to, as you said, to keep it scientifically accurate as people go searching for some of the you know, questions they have about the science, it being accurate, it will be a surprise, I think, to some people.
As an audience member myself, you know, like the greatest surprise is always, you know, finding out that something in a film is true, you know, and that I can explore that if I found that interesting. So, you know, if an audience member can latch onto a fact that they hear in the film, you know that it is true. You know, I think that that's so much more valuable in the end than just making up a word and have it be something else. You know, like the real world is fantastic enough that we shouldn't have to make up very much to make an engaging story.
So what was your biggest challenge in making this film?
I think trying to convince the scientific community that, you know, my intentions were pure, that I wanted to make a film that was accurate. I didn't want to just make a film that scared people away or honest or just after a quick cash grab or something, you know, and that was hard because I didn't really have any contacts within the science community or anything. And we were made for a very low budget. And that was probably the biggest challenge, was just trying to get that film to the right people and try to get that message across.
So as you look to the future and your future film projects, are you going to continue to cover scientifically related issues, or are you going in a totally different direction?
I would like to stay doing science factual films for the rest of my life, really. Like, I think it's kind of just this endless grab bag of subjects that I can explore. And they excite me in a way that other film ideas really don't anymore. So I'd like to keep down this road.
The film is The Perfect 46. It's part of the lineup at the Woods Hole Film Festival. We'll have a link to the entire schedule for the festival at our website, capeandislands.org. Brett Bonowitz, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up after a break, we discuss Cotton Road, a film being screened at the Woods Hole Film Festival that follows cotton from the field to the clothing rack. You're listening to The Point. Americans consume nearly 20 billion new items of clothing each year, yet few of us know how our clothes are made, much less who produces them. Cotton Road is a film being screened at the Woods Hole Film Festival that follows the commodity of cotton from South Carolina farms to Chinese factories to illuminate the work and industrial process in a global supply chain. Filmmaker Laura Kissel joins us on the phone. Good morning, Laura.
Good morning.
So I think it's safe to say that most of us don't give too much thought to where our clothes come from, much less where the materials our clothes are made from come from. But what made you start to think about this and decide to make a film about it?
Yeah, well, in the early 2000s, I was on a cotton farm in rural Georgia, and I was making a completely different film. And I was watching on this farm cotton being produced, and I followed it all the way through the production cycle into a cotton gin in a very small town called Araby, Georgia, where maybe 500 people live. And I found out that all that cotton then, after it was ginned, was shipped to China. And I was really surprised by that. And, you know, in some ways, I think we're all familiar with the fact that the American economy used to supply a lot of jobs around textiles. Most of them were shipped overseas. But we kind of forget that, I think, quickly. And we also then, you know, don't have an image in our minds anymore of what it takes to actually produce the clothing that we wear, because it's no longer in front of us. So I was really interested in making a film that would show the supply chain for a typical cotton product and really tell that story from the perspective of the lives of all the workers in the supply chain.
Yeah. Now, so you started on another project, which is how you found the farmer, I'm assuming, in South Carolina. You had that portion of it and you said, okay, now I want to follow this. So you just followed the cotton as it moved through the chain.
That's right. And sometimes when I'm reflecting on the whole process that I went through to make the film, I think, oh, there should have been a documentary made about the making of, because it was also a journey unto itself just to find all of the people who are in a typical supply chain who could speak to me every step along the way. But I received a Fulbright, which enabled me to go to China and live there for quite a while. And once I was there, I had the support first of the Chamber of Commerce office for the state of South Carolina in Shanghai, and that opened doors to people who owned factories. And from there, I just followed person to person and eventually was able to put the story together.
Yeah, I was going to say, I wondered how you got some of these people to talk to you. There are several scenes in the film that show various chemicals being sprayed on the cotton crop. In the research for the film, did you look into the environmental impacts of cotton being grown in the U.S.?
A little bit. You know, it's certainly something that's a very complicated topic. In some ways, the introduction of the genetically modified seeds and the use of lots of chemicals like glyphosate have made it possible for farmers to spray less. That is, the seeds that they plant now are resistant to a lot of bugs. And so there are fewer, pesticides being sprayed overall. The farmer actually in the film, Carl Brown, speaks to that point. But you know, there are, of course, long-term impacts, and a lot of them are kind of unknown as the glyphosate is applied over and over again. Crops, or weeds rather, become resistant to it, and you can see in one scene in the film where Carl Brown's worker, Grover Tyler, is driving the tractor and commenting on how large the weeds are and that they need to mow them down and spray them so that they can kill them. But they keep coming back, you know, ferociously every year. So while that could be a topic that I may have explored or thought about exploring, rather I wanted to focus more on the lives of workers and really make the story be driven by the human beings who are producing the crop and then, of course, shipping it and working with it overseas until it comes back as a product. So I really was focused more on workers and human stories rather than on larger environmental impacts. However, I think in the film, when you watch it, you really see that, right? Mm-hmm. You can't avoid the fact that a lot of chemicals are being sprayed on the crops because you see it happening. And when you're in the factories in China, you can see the dust in the air and you can see that the workers aren't wearing masks. So I feel like the environmental story is there in the film, but it's really very much in the images that audiences are consuming and watching.
Yeah, and we have a clip that I want to play from Carl Brown, the cotton farmer in South Carolina. I had no idea. I guess it's like with any kind of farming, it's a lot more complicated than we think it is, and there's a lot of things to worry about. So here's Carl Brown.
My grandfather, according to my father, back in about 1919. Had a good cotton crop, and light to went broke, lost the farm he was buying because he had a good cotton crop, and he picked it, and when he was picking, it was after World War I, the cotton price was high, about 30 cents a pound, and when he got, and in those days, they're hand-picked, and he got it picked and ginned, and when he hauled it to market, it was 5 cents a pound. That always kind of rides in my mind, and of course this cotton is committed to a certain cotton merchant, but we haven't priced it yet, unfortunately, because the cotton prices decline. When the world gets in bad economic situation, the American farmer gets pneumonia, and I worry a lot about that. China's going to have to buy a good portion of this crop. Or somebody like them, because we're only going to, you know, depend on what's made, what they're talking about made. Only about a third of this cotton is going to be used in the United States. Two thirds of it, maybe 70% of it's got to get in a box and go somewhere.
I was stunned on two things: how much of the cotton is manufactured overseas, and also this pricing thing. Where he says the cotton's committed, but he doesn't know how much it's going to sell for.
Yeah, and in 2008, when I was filming with him on his farm, that's when we had the global economic collapse, of course, and the high price that cotton was fetching that year was maybe around 90, 93 cents, but by the fall, after the economic collapse, or around that same time, the price was 39 cents a pound.
Wow.
And so at the same time, and he speaks to this in the film, the input costs are soaring. You know, gasoline prices, diesel fuel prices are through the roof. They're three and sometimes four times as much as he paid the previous year. And so, yes, you can really see, I think, the volatility of growing a crop like cotton in terms of not only, you know, how much it costs to produce it, the costs go up every year, as well as, of course, the fluctuating global market for the commodity itself. So it's a pretty tenuous crop to grow. It's very difficult to grow for lots of reasons.
Yeah, and the cotton goes through so many hands, from the farmer who grows it until it gets to China. I've got another clip that we hear from someone in the supply chain.
Normally, this time of year, we'll be ginning it, putting it in the warehouse, taking it right back out and shipping it out. But, I mean, there's just none moving. So it's just kind of a standstill economy worldwide. When the Walmarts, the Targets, they got in this business, they buy so much, they are actually telling the mills how much they're going to pay for that finished product. no more, no less. And if they want to, and they being the world's largest user, what does that mill could do? Who's making all the money? And not us.
That seems like a question a lot of people are asking, right? Who's making all the money? Not us.
Yeah, that's Drake Perro. He's the owner of a cotton gin in Cameron, South Carolina. And, of course, you know, just one of the many workers in the supply chain who's constantly being squeezed. Right, it's incredibly volatile. And he brings up, of course, the very important point that, you know, Walmart and Target and lots of these very large mass retailers have kind of changed the whole scene around how we consume clothing. So this idea of clothing as something that's mass produced and therefore can be consumed in large quantities really has changed so much, not only about our consumption habits and our buying habits, but also on the production side in terms of how much control they have to kind of determine what's going to drive the market. And in many cases now, it's become price. People want to pay low prices for clothing, and it's something that didn't used to be that way. We used to pay a lot more for clothing than we do today.
Right. And so it heads out on these container ships, on the ships, and it heads to sea. Then it arrives in China. And there are a number of steps before the cotton becomes clothing. It's cleaned, spun, set up on I don't know, the looms, creating the fabric. And there's a scene in the film of a Chinese worker repairing fabric. And she describes how often she works overtime when it gets busy. And since their work is counted on time, she can't leave freely. And it appears from the film that they often sometimes sleep and eat at the factory. Was that fairly common in the places you visited?
Oh, yeah, that's very common in China, actually. It's kind of a holdover from the days of government-owned factories. That is, workers kind of expect that there's going to be some kind of dormitory situation and that they will be fed on the job, at least lunch and maybe dinner if they're being asked to work extremely long hours. So it's actually quite common, and in fact, I think some of these larger factories that you know, lots and lots of mass retailers are using will sometimes try to lure workers by offering other kinds of amenities, like maybe computer classes at night or things like that. So, so definitely, in the film you see, and I think this really makes a really interesting point too about the way you see people living in the United States, which is a lot more private, and the way you see people living in China, at least in these factories, the workers, that is, you know, they're living and also working in the same space. And in some ways, that, for me as a filmmaker, it made it easy for me to, you know, capture more intimate scenes because the factory was, you know, or right across from the factory was their home, essentially, or their dorm room where they were living out their days when they're not working.
At one point, the worker who you're interviewing she's repairing the fabric, and she says, "Every day it's the same. Unlike you guys running around seeing the outside world, how wonderful is that? Your work is easy. You just talk." And then she laughs. What went through your head when she said that?
Well, I just love that scene. And, you know, I'm the kind of filmmaker, the kind of documentary filmmaker that wants to maybe also, you know, put something in my film that lets audiences know that it was made by somebody. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a really interesting point that she is making. That is, you know, she's pointing out our class and our privilege, the fact that me and my assistant, who was college educated in China, Li Zhen, she was the producer of the show with me in China, that we have this great opportunity to have different kinds of choices that we can make in our lives about what we want to do and how we want to spend our time. And that's about education, it's about class. And so she's really pointing that out. And I think that's incredibly important to me as the filmmaker to have that in viewers' minds as they're watching. Mm-hmm. I felt very privileged to make this film and very much felt, you know, my own place in some ways in the supply chain. I'm a consumer of goods, and it was really, you know, very interesting for me to be able to have the opportunity to meet everyone along the way, and very humbling too, yeah. Especially in China.
So we meet some of the individuals who work in the China garment factories, and their stories are not all happy. Some have been separated from their families to come and work. Others have had to give up on education or personal goals and aspirations to come and work in these factories. And I know there was one girl who talked about she was disappointed when she got into the factory. She was expecting something very different.
Yes. In fact, I think she says that she had seen television shows of what it might be like to have a job in a city and to work in a factory, and that they were sort of glamorized a bit on television. And then when she arrived there, she really discovered quite a different experience. And in fact, her own story, I think you're referring to the scene with Liu Qianfeng, her own story is quite sad that she had to leave home when she was 18. She had to leave school. She wasn't quite finished with high school yet. And her parents are quite poor, and she needed to go to work to be able to help them raise money so that they could repair the roof on their house because it leaked every time it rained. And her mother had borrowed money from her aunt, and so that money needed to be repaid. So here she is, 18 years old, being sent out to work. And, of course, as you point out, finding a very different reality in the factory than the one that she imagined she would find. You know, I feel like the stories of workers like her, and there were many that we documented, and a lot of scenes, of course, on the cutting room floor that you wish could be included in a film like this. But it really does point out to you just the discrepancies, I think, in this global textile exchange that we have. The workers are paid so little, and there's not a lot of accountability for on the part of companies to ensure that people are paid better or paid more or given the supports that they need to be able to truly improve their lives. So I think you really see that in scenes like the one that you just quoted.
And of course, there's been a backlash in the U.S. over working conditions in overseas clothing factories, and perhaps to appease some consumers, some American companies have required the overseas factories that make their clothes pass an inspection. But as a small factory owner in your film points out, it would be impossible to pass the inspection standards and still be able to stay in business, especially given the price the American companies are paying for the clothes.
Right, and that really points out that a lot of this is driven by price now. That is, consumers have kind of been schooled over the past 20 or 30 years that we should pay less and less for the clothing that we purchase. And I even met, this is not in the film, but I met someone in China who actually, whose role was to source clothing from manufacturers in China for very large retailers in the United States, and he said, you know, sometimes the retailers will call him and just say, I would like, 100,000 T-shirts or more, and I want to sell them for $19.99. And so they don't care what it looks like, or they don't really necessarily think much about the style. They're just thinking about the price point. They want to sell it for that. So it was his job to go to these factories and try to find people who would be able to make the object, the T-shirt, whatever it is, for that point of sale, basically. Mm-hmm. So, a lot of it is driven by price now, unfortunately, and I think that what you see is a kind of race to the bottom where, of course, who gets left out and who benefits the least is the manual labor worker at the sort of end of the supply chain.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that's incredible is, you know, you think that you would be seeing these, you know, in our computerized age, a lot of this manufacturing being machines, but with these they're doing hand. I mean, they're piece by piece. A majority of what we're seeing is not automated, but it's being done by a person. And when you just think of the sheer numbers of you know, pieces of clothing, articles of clothing that are coming out of these factories, it's just mind-blowing.
Yes, and I think, again, that's something that we forget. You know, we exported this industry a few decades ago to other parts of the world, and what you really forget is how much manual labor that there is involved in making a simple item of clothing like a T-shirt. Yeah. So I think, you know, that's one of the things that Cotton Road can do is really show viewers that work and that labor, which we seem to no longer really consider.
The film is Cotton Road. It will be screened on Tuesday, July 29th at 5 p.m. at the Lilly Auditorium. Filmmaker Laura Kissel, thanks so much, Laura, for taking the time to talk with us.
Oh, thanks for speaking with me.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.